after the crucifixion is the only gospel which tells us the name of Judas Iscariot's father, because he probably was dead by this time. My, what it must have meant to have a son like Judas. God is so gracious. Matthew, Mark, Luke never mention the father's name, which probably was well known. He might even have been a true servant of God. But now, 60 years later, John is at liberty, and he calls him the son of Simon. Simon was gone. This old Simon was not gone, and he was a bit of a snob. A woman comes in, and she we have to back up a little bit. A woman in the city, verse 37, who was a sinner. Now, we don't know whether she was a prostitute or not. I don't think we should read in any more than we have to. She was a sinner. Simon, of course, practically called her a woman of the street. And he was eating in the Pharisee's house, and she brought an alabaster box of ointment, stood at his feet behind him weeping, began to wash his feet with her tears, did wipe them with the hair of her head, kissed his feet, and anointed them with ointment. Now when the Pharisee who had bidden him saw it, he spoke within himself. He didn't say it out loud, the old rascal. He just thought it, saying, "This man, if he were a prophet, would have known who and what manner of woman this is that toucheth him, for she is a sinner." But the Lord knew his heart. That's a nice lesson from the parables. All kinds of little moral lessons. And Jesus answering said unto him, "Simon, I have somewhat to say to thee." And he said, "Master, say on." "Teacher, say on, you're the teacher." There was a certain creditor, he had two debtors, and you know all about the story. 500 denarii was owed, and the other 50. You don't need to bother about the value of a denarii. All you need to think of is the proportion. 50 against 500. "And when they had nothing to pay, frankly forgave them both. Tell me, therefore, which of them will love him most?" Simon said, "I suppose he to whom he forgave most." He said unto him, "Thou hast rightly judged." Turned to the woman and said unto Simon, "Seest thou this woman? I entered into thine house, and thou gavest me no water for my feet. She hath washed my feet with her tears, wiped them with the hair of her head, her glory on his feet. Thou gavest me no kiss, but this woman, since I came in, hath not ceased to kiss my feet. My head with oil lieth not anoint, but this woman hath anointed my feet with the ointment, and it was very precious stuff. Wherefore I say unto thee, her sins, which are many, are forgiven." I take it that was not because of what she did, but what she did was the result of having been forgiven. "Her sins, which are many, are forgiven. She loves much. But to whom little is forgiven, the same loveth little." He said unto her, "Thy sins are forgiven." They that were eating with him began to say within themselves, "Who is this that forgiveth sins also?" And he said to the woman, "Thy faith hath saved thee. Go in peace." This is a lesson in gratitude. Gratitude. The greater our appreciation of the Lord and his mercy and grace is, the more gratitude we shall show. This woman had prepared this ointment. She wasn't just passing by and happened to have it in her purse. It was a flask. It was a potter, a clay a vessel of some kind, a little urn. She had prepared this out of a loving heart. She had gone determined to get to his feet. in the presence of one of his enemies. Who knows, maybe Simon was a Sanhedrinist, maybe he was one of the men who were determined to destroy the Lord. And she would have known this. Oh, goodness. Let us ask ourselves, how much do we show our gratitude to God? Forgiven much shall love much. And there it is. His love to us is so great. And I love that verse, that hymn by the man who was going blind, broken in heart because his fiancée was giving him up. And he went and afterwards penned those words, "Oh, love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean's depths its flow may richer, fuller be. O cross that lifteth up my head, I would not dare to flee from thee." And so on. The man is overwhelmed with a sense of the gratitude for what God was to him. What about this, gentlemen? What about it? How is it affecting my heart now? How does it affect my heart 7 days a week? Because I don't think if it, I believe that if it is not affecting my heart through the 6 days of the week, when I come to the table, my worship is going to be in words only, with little depth to it. Because worship is not something you turn off and on like a tap. Shall we open our worship? You mean we only start this on Sunday morning? Worship is not something we do only. Worship is an attitude of soul toward God. And this is the woman. And it's in gratitude. I'm going to take again. I've overstepped. So have your little date here.
Be back by 10 after.
Confess that I do feel sorry for running over time with you. It gives long sessions and whatnot. The mystery of uncorrected wrong. During this period of the king's absence, there are many, many weird kind of situations. One of them is set up here. E.W. Rogers, I'm just looking to see what the rather neat name he has in this. Yeah, paradoxical events during the king's absence. Paradoxical events during the king's absence. Now, in that, he mentions this woman. There is, there is unchecked persecution, chapter 14, verses 1 to 12. There is Gentile blessing, which, of course, the Jews never expected. It's a paradoxical thing. Jews, Gentiles in blessing, 14, verses 13 to 21. There is international strife, 14:22-36. And of course that is because he says this is set forth by the storm on the lake. He sees a spiritual lesson there. Confusion, strife internationally, on the waters where he once sat and taught. But now it's a threatening churning evil. Whilst the Lord is on high praying, his own are in the midst of the storm, but he manifests himself, and they find him to be superior to the elements which so troubled them. He has not forgotten them. He comes to them. The waters cannot swallow them, for they cannot swallow him, and he becomes their protector. None need sink. It was in the fourth watch, that is between 3 and 6 a.m., the darkest hour before the dawn. All these are paradoxes. They are so contrary to what we might have expected. But the just shall live by faith. He leaves his own here in these circumstances. And among those paradoxical things, I have included the mystery of uncorrected wrong. Luke 18:1. He spoke a parable unto them to this end, that men ought always to pray and not to faint, saying, there was in a city a judge who feared not God nor regarded man. There was a widow in that city, and she came unto him, saying, avenge me of mine adversary. And he would not for a while, but afterward he said within himself, though I fear not God nor regard man, yet because this widow troubleth me, I will avenge her, lest by her continual coming she weary me. And the Lord said, hear what the unjudged saith. And shall not God avenge his own elect, who cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? I tell you that he will avenge them speedily. Nevertheless, when the Son of Man cometh, shall he find faith on the earth? It's a very paradoxical situation. The woman is one of those for whom God has pledged himself as a special protector. He is the one who cares for the widow and the fatherless, for the orphan. He has this responsibility, and yet this woman is plowing through a horrendous difficulty. First, a city. I don't like cities at all. And coming back to Toronto, which is a large city now, somewhere in the vicinity of 3 million people, Greater Toronto. Of course, you've got much bigger. They're all everything bigger down here. But I have said, and my wife Barbara has said to me repeatedly, you know, I'm glad we don't live in this city anymore. A city is a heartless place. Nobody speaks to anybody. We live in a little village. There are only about 12 shops in it altogether, and three or four of those shops are owned and run by believers. Everybody speaks to you as you pass. As a matter of fact, if somebody walks past and doesn't speak to anybody, they say, it's a suspicious character, you know. Walked right past me. They, even if they don't speak, they've got a funny little way of nodding their heads like this. You see men passing, something in their hand, and just give their head a wee toss. And they say, that's a brave day, isn't it? Or it's a bit stormy, or it's a bit wet, or whatever. And in about a week, everybody in the village knew who we were. Now, I suppose we stood out like a sore thumb, or like two sore thumbs, because of this old codger like me and a younger wife. And then we came from Canada. He said, whatever brought you from Canada? Everybody here wants to go to Canada. And then you come back here after living for 23 or 24 years in Canada, and you come back to live here. Oh, yeah, you're the couple up on top of the brae there, yeah. There's something very nice about that. Neighbors help each other. Neighbors on either side of us have keys to our house. We have keys to their house. People on one side, they're opening up our mail, sticking it in an envelope, things that they think are important, and mailing it on to us. But you know, a city is a hard place. It's cold, and you can be terribly lonely in a city. I think the loneliest times of my life, and I've spent a fairly lonely kind of a life, all told. I've always been a bit that way. But you know, when I find myself in a city as I've done, in like New York or Chicago or Cleveland, one of these places, I feel terribly lonely in the city. Not when I'm in the home of a Christian, I'm not talking about that. But just in the city. I hate cities, I don't like them. You can be terribly lonely in the middle of that whole mob, and you know it's all going to be judged, and you know that underneath the surface is endless corruption and rottenness. That's where the woman was. Also, a city is a terribly impersonal place. You're just one more character walking along the street, and who cares? If you fall dead, some people are going to pass you, because the whole war cry is, don't get involved, Joe, don't get involved. Look the other way. She had an adversary. this widow lived in a city. That was bad enough. She had an adversary. She had no relations, otherwise they would have helped her. The adversary showed no mercy. Avenge me of mine adversary. She had one. He would not for a while. She's talking to the judge. But the adversary was after her. You know, the story turns up in other parts of the Bible for about this kind of thing. Pay me what you owe me, or I will throw you in, and you will stay there till you pay me the last penny of the debt. That's what happens to debtors in the city. So she had an adversary. Somebody was after her about money she owed or something she couldn't get or pay for or whatever it was, and there was no mercy. Was it because of a death? Was it because of debt? We don't know. There was a judge, but in most cities, he was an unjust judge. Now there are unjust judges who are godless men. There are godless men who are not unjust judges. They still believe that we live in a country which professes to live by the law, and they will uphold this. They're few and far between, mind you, when the crush is on. But this man was an unjust judge, and he had no fear of God and no respect for men. And yet he was her only resource or recourse. A plea ignored. She begged the judge to help her, to defend her, to do something about it. And he would not. For a long time, he just simply shrugged his shoulders and said, I'm sorry, lady. It's your problem. You know, that's so characteristic of our societies. It's all very well to read of it in Mexico City or in Croatia, where they go in deliberately and shoot all the old people and the children just to clean out the whole place, so that when they take it, it will be racially cleansed. It's a dreadful thought, isn't it? But here, this is in a city which is working on. It's not the middle of a war. It's just in a certain city. And her plea is ignored. Now that is the unexpected kind of situation for the Lord to paint. And yet she is there. She is in this mess. But then there is a God who hears. There is a God who cares. Who acts behind the scenes. I give you a few quotations there from Isaiah 45, from Romans 8, from Revelation 6, 9 to 11, and from 12, 14 to 17. At your leisure, you can look them up. We sometimes say God is still on the throne and he will remember his own. But I tell you, when the torch is blazing on your face, it's very hard to get hold of that, isn't it? When you're down, you can't get up. Now, this is one of the anomalies of this age. This is one of these odd things. The storm on the lake, everything has sixes and sevens. And the Lord doesn't seem to be there. Well, he isn't there. Humanly speaking, he's up on the mountain interceding for them. It doesn't even say that they cried to him, mind you. He came because he saw a need. And in this case, the man finally turns around and he says, because the widow troubleth me, though I fear not God, nor regard not man, nor regard man, yet because the widow troubleth me. Now, this is one of those parables where the teaching is by way of contrast and not by comparison. Are we to think of God as an unjust judge? Or are we to think of him as the adversary? Or is God going to say, finally, well, because this person's battering me with prayer night and day about their need for the family, a sick wife, a dying child, loss of my job, loss of my home, and am I going to have to nag God until he finally says, well, because this person's wearying me? That's not the message of it at all. But it is, whatever, however difficult the circumstances may be and however hard the hearts of the people round about can be, there is a God up there who is watching, and he knows all about this widow. Because he says, and shall not God avenge his own elect, who cry day and night unto him, though he bear long with them? The mystery of delayed answer to prayer. John the Baptist was the Lord's cousin. He was in prison. He knew that the Lord had said that he was the anointed one, and he preached that. He knew that one of the things the Lord had said about being anointed was that he was anointed to open the prison, to set at liberty the prisoners and those who were oppressed. And here is John, both in prison and oppressed, falsely by a rotten animal of a man who was living with his brother's wife. But it was worse than that. If I ever got started to you on the Herods and the relationships between them, it was terrible. And yet here's the Lord's own cousin and his forerunner in prison. And he said, are you really he that should come? His faith was shaking. Has yours never shaken? You know, the Lord only tests as steeply as this those very special people for whom he has special purposes, and on whom he can use these very special trials to develop deeper faith and deeper confidence in himself. There are some of us, alas, myself, I'm afraid, on occasions when I could not have handled this. And he didn't say, go back and tell John, yes, it's okay, I am the Messiah. He said, no. Go back and tell John what you see and hear. He will understand. And then he added, there was nobody greater than John. But he didn't say that here. He says, and I'm trying to recall the exact words because I don't like inexact quotations, but blessed is he who shall not be stumbled in me. In other words, John, hold on. You are not going to be liberated from that prison, in effect. You're going to be carried out of it dead. But blessed is he whosoever shall not be stumbled in me. We do not know, I do not know, in these terribly difficult days, what troubles and trials God might ask us to go through, and he may not always give us the answer immediately. He might say, you'll have to hang on in faith, because the Lord will avenge her. He will avenge her. But when? Though he bear long with them. God is bearing with that unjust judge. God is holding back his judgment. His judgment isn't always poured out on the persecutors. He did not stop in and hold back that traitor who betrayed Tyndale to his enemies. He did not hold them back while they tied him to a stake and then put a rope around his neck and strangled him to death and then burned his body at the stake. Mercifully, they didn't burn him alive. And God didn't step in. He didn't deliver him. He didn't deliver Cranmer. He didn't deliver the other men who were burned at the stake. He didn't deliver the young women in some cases who were put tied to stakes when the tide was low And as it came in, and the water came up and up and up, and they cried to God, no, they died. He bore long, but I tell you, the day of judgment on those who did these things is going to be severe. We have to trust God, even when it looks as though he doesn't care. But I know, and you know, that he does. He will surely avenge, though he bear long with them. He hasn't promised deliverance from every trial, and this is one of those anomalies. Now glance briefly at the last one, the laborers and their pay. That is in Matthew chapter 20. And here again, some have found problems with this. And of course, there's ample room for difference of opinion, I am thankful to say. You have to look at everything in context. And the context here begins at verse 27 of the previous chapter. Because our chapters are not divinely inspired, though I'm very, very glad of the people who made them, because how would you ever have found anything? But at verse 27 of chapter 19, Peter says, "Behold, we have forsaken all and have followed thee. What shall we have therefore?" Now, the rich young man, you've got to go way back, but this is enough from Peter. "We have forsaken all. We walked away from those boats and the fish, and we have followed thee from the very beginning. What shall we have therefore?" Jesus, what's going to be our reward for this? Jesus said unto them, "Verily I say unto you, ye that have followed me in the regeneration," that is, of course, the regeneration of the earth. He's referring to the whole recreation of society in the millennium and probably reaching into the eternal state. "When the Son of Man shall sit on the throne of his glory, ye also shall sit upon 12 thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Everyone that hath forsaken houses or brethren or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or lands for my name's sake shall receive 100-fold and shall have everlasting and shall inherit everlasting life. But many that are first shall be last, and the last shall be first. For the kingdom of heaven is like a man that is a householder, who went out early in the morning to hire laborers into his vineyard, and when he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard." Now this was a standard wage for a day's work. "He went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace, and said unto them, Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give you. And they went their way. Again, he went out about the sixth hour and the ninth hour and did the same. At about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing idle and saith unto them, Why stand ye here all the day idle? And they say unto him, Because no man has hired us. He saith unto them, Go ye also into the vineyard, and whatever is right, that shall you receive. So when evening was come, the Lord of the vineyard saith unto his steward, Call the laborers and give them their hire, beginning at the last unto the first. And when he came that were hired about the 11th hour, they received every man a denarius. And when the first came, they supposed that they should have received more. They likewise received every man a denarius. And when they had received it, they murmured against the householder, saying, These last have worked but 1 hour, and thou hast made them equal unto us, who have borne the burden and heat of the day. But he answered one of them and said, Friend, I do thee no wrong. Didst not thou agree with me for a denarius? Take what is thine and go thy way. I will give unto this last, even as unto thee. Is it not lawful for me to do what I will with mine own? Is thine eye evil because I am good? So, the last shall be first, the first last. For many are called, but few are chosen. And that last sentence, of course, is the difficult part. Here we have, I think this is all linked to Peter. What are we going to have? We're among the first. We've worked from the very beginning. There's a kind of, what shall we call it? A little bit of the materialist here. The bargaining spirit with God. Does it seem to sit right that I would dare to bargain with God? He who gave everything for me, he who gave all for me, and I am going to say like Peter, now what do I get out of this? You know, some men have gone out in the bad, bad old days of missionary work and were clubbed to death and eaten by the people whom they went to preach the gospel to. God didn't intervene. That was all the reward they got. Bishop Hannaford. And there were others. What about one man who for days was laid flat on his back in Burma and his feet tied to a strut on the wall, and he was left there with his hands tied behind his back, and they stuffed some food in his mouth a couple or three times a day and left him there. Mosquitoes, bed bugs, vermin crawling over him. And it seemed as though God didn't care. Are we to be mercenary? Peter's mercenary. He said, what are we going to get out of this? And the answer is, you may not get anything at all out of this. You may get beatings as Paul got. Have you ever read 2 Corinthians 3 and outlined the four, or I think five, lists of sufferings that Paul gives us there? Was he simply moaning? Was he whining? Was he holding himself up as the great sufferer? I don't think so. There must be a reason there. Five long lists winding up with a physical torment that he said was like a stake driven into his very body. Or I've forgotten which of the translators called it the agony of a physical impalement. It wasn't a thorn in the flesh. It was a goad, a stake pounded into his flesh. And it wasn't a weekend flu. He had it for 14 years and he begged God to take it away, and God said, no, my grace is sufficient for thee. My strength is made perfect in your weakness. And so Paul shrugged his shoulder and said, well, I suppose that's my fate, and whatever comes, I'll grin and bear it. No, he didn't. He said, most gladly, therefore, will I rather suffer that the power of God may rest upon me. We do not work for God for pay. We do not bargain with God in a mercenary spirit. We may see here, for example, the Jew complaining because, after all, he had been serving God for over 1,800 years before the Gentiles were brought in. And now these Gentiles are being forgiven and rewarded and all the rest of it, and we have been your children. Maybe that's in the background of it too. But it also means that everything will be rewarded in its proper time. And that proper time is not necessarily what we see as the time that we should be rewarded. For often we do things for the Lord and for his people, and about all we get out of it is a kick in the teeth. And if you don't think that's right, just keep on living. You're young yet. You're young yet. And you will find that this will sometimes come from the most unexpected quarters. Are you ready for this? If you're not, then you're not learning here. Another thing that's brought out here is the sovereignty of God. He said, it's mine. Am I not at liberty to do what I wish? Who made me this way? I tell you, we all have our catalogue of ills. and you have a spare hour, if you would like to know my catalog of aches and pains, I'd be very glad to, provided you have an hour to spare. But you see, that's not it. Maybe it might take longer, but that's not it. That's not the whole story. What about that day when we stand before Him and when in grace He actually rewards us for the things that we have done, which compared with what He did for us are as nothing? It will all be of grace, and who are we to say, what have you done to me? Not only that, the last shall be first, and first shall be last. You know, I'm a preacher, and I suppose maybe I have indulged in this sometimes, I don't know. But I hear people saying, you know, we had a wonderful series of meetings, Brother so-and-so and I, and we had a very fruitful time, and you know what? We saw 12 people saved. And you think, well, boy, it's going to be wonderful for preachers like that who see people saved. But then, of those who were saved, what about the old granny who taught that person the scriptures 5, 10, 15, 30, 40, 50 years ago? Will she not get reward? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. What about the person who called at their door and took them to the meeting so they could hear the gospel? Oh, yes, they get a reward. What about the woman? I remember my mother going over and helping a woman to do her washing. So she had a big family, and she was the greatest, I was going to say plutter, but you wouldn't know what a plutter is anyway. She was a handless kind of a person who never caught up in her work. And my mother went and helped her with her washing. And they didn't have washing machines in those days. They did it in a tub on a scrub board, you know, with Lifebuoy soap, so that that woman could come out to the gospel. And yet my mother never preached. And as far as I know, never had the joy of leading somebody specifically to Christ. She was a very humble little woman. What about all the other people? What about the father, the mother who brought up the child, and now he gets saved years later? What about the Sunday school teacher who pounded the scriptures into that child's memory? Now a man of 40, he says suddenly, and then when I was standing in the dark and I didn't know how to believe and I didn't know how to think, suddenly a verse came to my mind. Where do you think it came from? Written in the clouds? Written on the wall? God serve him a piece of paper and say, read that, there's what you do. No. A verse came to my mind. Some long forgotten Sunday school teacher possibly made that child memorize a verse, or 10 or 50 verses. And then the big preacher comes along and he said, I led these people to Christ. And he thinks he's going to get a wonderful reward. And I'm sure he will. But he's not the only one who's going to get a reward. And maybe in that day, some people that we rarely think of will get a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful reward at the hand of the one who knows how to evaluate all the links in the chain, and not just the preacher who stood up on the platform and did the final wee job. Last shall be first. First shall be last. But a sovereign God knows the end from the beginning. And I have known people cut down young, knew a very dear friend, a girl, who from the time she was about 8 suffered from an incurable bone disease, worked her way through school. She had broken her bones all went eggshell thin, that particular disease, the name of which I can't even remember at the moment. She graduated as a social worker. One arm was shorter than the other. Her bones were all broken. She lay for 8 months in a total body cast. That means head, neck, everything right down to here, with a hole in the front of the cast and a hole up here to let the hot air out right through a summer. in a hot city here in the United States because she had to have her neck rebuilt. The bones were all gone to pieces. Now, I'm putting this in layman's language. I don't want Rob Bellew to start telling me no such thing ever happened after the class, but that dear soul suffered all her life. Unfortunately, they tried to treat this disease with radiation when she was young, and she was the only living person at that time. At her age, she lived to be slightly over 30. She died of cancer. I took her funeral, and the place was packed. The public funeral parlor was packed with the people with whom she worked. She did her work as a social worker out of a wheelchair. Her interviews had to be done on tape because she couldn't even write anymore. Her hands were so deformed. Back, legs, everything.